You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and oh, we've got a treat for everybody today. Joining us is the Chief Commercial Officer of Cresco Labs. Please welcome to the podcast, Greg Butler.
Hello, Manish. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Greg. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's a little bit of a cold day here in Chicago, but It's a Friday. I'm excited to see people in our stores later today.
Mm-hmm. And today is December 10th, 2021, but this will come out in the new year. So happy new year to everybody.
Happy new year.
So Greg, I guess my first question is, what is a chief commercial officer?
great question. And I think it's one of those titles you get where you can keep adding or subtracting things under you as you go.
It's just generic enough, right? It's whatever exactly. You want it to be.
You're asking the question because it's actually doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
In our world, I think it means many different things for many different companies. So I'll just kind of explain what I do for Cresco Labs. And,
sure.
And that is what a chief commercial officer is for us. So okay. Under my team, all of our wholesale sales teams report into me. Mm-hmm. So across our footprint, our retail team I have the pleasure of working with that team. Our M&A and integration team, our brand teams, both from the retail customer experience side and wholesale brand side, mm-hmm. Are with me. And then our business kind of administration, which runs all of the things that makes the company corporate office work. Those are all with me.
Okay, so just to summarize, it's admin, it's cultivation, it's brands, it's wholesale, it's M&A. Is it also retail?
I was going to say, I love our cultivation team. They are not with me, but I have the pleasure of selling and branding everything that they produce for us.
Got it. Okay, so it sounds like it's almost everything except running the cultivation and the retail.
Yeah, I think more of it's a lot more of our revenue generating side of the business.
Okay.
And just in all of those departments.
Got it.
Okay, it changes, one of the most, interesting things about this industry at this time is how quickly the industry is moving, how quickly we as a company have to move, and how we have to kind of structure based on all of that. It's pretty refreshing because mm-hmm. I've spent a lot of my career at bigger companies where org structures can be such sticky things.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love to say, we have two things that we can use. We've got dollars and people, and we should have the right to redeploy those, whatever we need to do to help kind of drive the business.
That's
my org today. Maybe next year we'll talk and it may look different.
Yeah. Next year, which this is coming out in next year. So close enough. The future is now. So let me ask you this, because you alluded to this, and I think it's a good place to start. Maybe you could give a little bit of a background on kind of who you are and what you were doing before Cresco.
Sure. Most recently before Cresco, I was in the alcohol industry at Molson Coors. Had the opportunity to run and work on our corporate strategy team over there with the head of the U.S. at the time. And then also ran the Miller Lite business for a number of years, which was an incredible experience of being in the, you'd call the vice product marketing and sales and operations side. Before that, spent some time at Walgreens working on the wellness strategy and customer segmentation and customer assortment and loyalty. And then part of that, a number of years in the private equity consulting space. Working with companies that were acquired and restructuring, and then started my career at Pfizer. And then ultimately when Pfizer Consumer Healthcare moved into J&J, was in those two sides. And so I've got a little bit of an interesting background and then MBA in the middle there, but started in healthcare Moved into kind of capital markets, CPG restructuring, then went into wellness retail, and then into Vice brand marketing. And so I think usually with Charlie loves to say, like, you know, where all those things are very much at play are cannabis.
Yeah, I was going to say this seems like the dream resume of like the training program you would put a cannabis executive through.
And I think, you know, what's interesting is there's so much to learn about the cannabis industry and its history, its culture, the uniqueness of it, which I don't think anyone coming from CPG can't look at that and say, I got it. It's hard. It's interesting. Right. It's hard. It's unique. It's got all sorts of challenges. The one nice thing, though, about this industry is particularly every quarter as we continue to grow here, there's more similarities popping up between how cannabis companies, part of cannabis companies are evolving that looks a little bit more like CPG, but then there's many, many parts that are like just so unique to this unique industry.
So let's put that to the side for a second, because I want to talk about that a little bit later. But just at the very beginning, I'm curious, you know, you're working at Molson, you know, you've got a pretty great track record of some, you know, blue chip companies. Why cannabis, and what excites you, and what makes you make the decision to get into the industry?
Yeah. It's probably the question I get often the most. It's either comes with the question of like, oh, how'd you get here? Or why did you go there? It's an interesting one that you get that responses. I am thrilled that I came over. Mm-hmm. And it started with me at Molson. We started looking at how, particularly in like places like Colorado and in California, as cannabis and adult use became, became a thing, how it was going to impact beer sales. Mm. And what type of volume, as we look to the future, should we assume is going to come from competition from cannabis? Because if you look at the history of beer, what we've always tracked is beer reigns supreme. For many, many decades. Then regulations changed on spirit advertising. And all of a sudden, spirit advertising came into play. And that really started to grow with innovation and availability, mm-hmm. how spirits were available for consumers. And that started to compete with a lot of occasions that were once like dominated by beer.
Interesting.
And then wine started to come in vogue, right? From a more of an older person's drink to now a, you know, for everyone.
Sure.
And then that started to compete for what was traditionally beer occasions. And so as you looked at cannabis, you're like, there's so many uses for cannabis, and people use it for so many different reasons. But clearly one of the uses for cannabis is to escape and have fun.
Right.
And, you know, those are very much occasions and relax are very much occasions where alcohol companies spend a lot of time focused on how do we win more volume there. And as we're looking at it, that was my, you know, first introduction. I've consumed cannabis for a while since high school. And it was my first introduction, kind of the business of where this industry was going to go. Hmm. And what was fascinating to me at the time is when you look at some of the headwinds that alcohol companies face, and particularly beer, it's going to be hard, is unfortunately like every young cohort today is still drinking beer, but it's drinking a little bit less than the cohort ahead of it.
Interesting.
And so when you model that out, it basically is just telling you, you're in this tough spot of just like structural decline, because we all know you drink more when you're younger, and then your consumption goes down as you age. And I'm like, and if you're starting, if the age group is starting lower, and it follows that same path, that's just a tough situation. Now, the good news for beer companies is there's so much great innovation happening. There's so much volume. So many people love that product. So it's a lot of fun. But I was looking at it, and I'm like, that is an interesting trend line. And then you looked at the cannabis data we saw, and it was, you've got interesting growth happening in two sides of the spectrum. You've got obviously what you'd expect. More 21 to 27 year olds are consuming cannabis as a cohort today than previous generations. So as they age, it's only going to go up. Mm-hmm. But you also have such a huge disproportional growth, or unexpected disproportional growth, coming for older consumers.
Right.
So you have like two sides of the spectrum, which really puts this industry And I think everyone, because, you know, I work for an MSO, so not everyone, but folks in my world are very much focused on annual numbers, quarterly results. Mm-hmm. But the first part that I found is fascinating with this industry is like, this is an industry that's just going to have structural growth behind it. Mm-hmm. Because every age group that ages up is cannibalizing a different age group at a higher usage rate, which gives you 3 years, 5 years, decades of growth ahead of you. So that was the one part where I'm like, this is just a really interesting consumer space. The second thing is, I looked at it and I'm like, you know, there is so many different needs and occasions. You've got a bit of pharma playing, mm-hmm. you've got a little bit of wellness playing, mm-hmm. and you've got fun. Like, yep. And you know, that's very much akin to my background of where I spend time. So all those spaces I think are interesting. They provide, you know, real importance to consumers. And you're at the very beginning of what I think is this journey, where brands are yet to really be built. We're pretty nascent on how we think about customer segmentation, mm-hmm. And customers. There's innovation, but I think we're only at the very beginning of some of the excitements and innovation that can happen in the space. And you have this really interesting dynamic of, you obviously have a lot of consumers who are very familiar with cannabis and know everything about it. And you have a lot of consumers who are going to enter this space who have a pretty rudimentary view of what it is.
Right.
And that just creates such a huge education opportunity. And if you're interested in brands, it creates a huge brand opportunity to build brands in the space. So that's what I got excited about it. I think we talked about this before. I was the second choice for this position.
You never mentioned that to me
before. I thought we talked about this. But yeah, no, I was the second choice. So my wife, who has an incredible background, somehow got connected to the founders. Mm-hmm. And they had this great coffee chat. And I think they ended with like, they're like, we need you. Like, you know what you're doing. We need you to come here. And my wife is very interested in kind of like food and corporate strategy and consulting strategy and CPG, which I think she calls insurgent CPG growth. Was like, no, I'm curious about this space because I love how insurgent brands are growing, but it's not my jam. And who you should talk to is my husband. Because of his background, So
your wife was the first choice for the job. She passed on it and recommended you, and you got it.
Second choice. That is
an amazing story.
Yeah. So anyways, and the interesting story too, that is years before I got a call, from a private equity fund that was trying to do a roll up of cannabis companies in Colorado. And it was a fund that I'd worked with in my past. And they were like, would you be interested? We're looking to bring in a CEO to run this thing. Came home. And I think this was like 2016, 2017. Can't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. Came home. I talked to my wife about it for a second. And she was like, no, I don't think we're a family that, you know, wants to put itself in this cannabis industry. We're not sure where it's going, .. And so like, okay, closed door. You know, you're not buying it. And then fast forward, you know, literally, it feels like a couple months later. And she comes home. She's like, I had this really interesting lunch. They really seemed interested in me. It's just not my thing, but I recommended you. It's just like, well, thanks A for being my headhunter.
Yeah.
And B, love the fact that a couple months ago when I got an offer from this company, you were a no-go, but you get the offer and it's like totally fine.
Totally. And it should be clear that she also seemed to pick a better company and a better market to be in though.
Yeah. So that's how I got introduced.
Just a comment, how quickly things change, right? I mean, how only a couple of years ago, it's like, maybe we're interested, but this isn't really right. And then as you dig in more, you know, time passes, you meet a different opportunity. You're like, you know what? This is maybe the right thing to try.
Yeah. And I think that is such a great point on just how far this industry, and just how culture around it has changed.
Right.
I remember leaving Molson. And clearly people were very excited.
And when was that? Sorry.
This was 2018.
Okay.
And people were excited. And you know, this is exciting, but I got like all the comments, like either this is exciting to that's interesting
to you're out of your mind.
Yeah. To like, that seems really risky. What are you doing? And so got all of the statements. And even friends, some friends were like, that is so amazing. And you got to give me an employee discount. what are you doing? Like,
right.
You're at one of the biggest beer brands in the world. You get to do really incredible stuff.
Greg's having his midlife crisis, I think.
And he's going, and there's like, what are you doing? It was one of those things, and I really do believe this for anyone in their professional development, like have some senior people that you work with, and for your past, keep them close because they become kind of your like advisory board. Mm-hmm. And I was like, am I crazy? Like, and you know, and I've got some really, really fortunate work from some really incredible people and, you know, from all walks of life. And some were like, yeah, I think you're crazy. I wouldn't do it. But a couple of them were like, look, I get it why you'd want to do it. And here's the thing, personal opinions aside of the space and the industry and all that stuff. And some are super supportive, by the way, but a couple of the middle were just like, I'm not sure, but they're like, I think this is one of those opportunities, by the way, you're talking about it, that if you don't go try it, you're going to regret it.
Mm.
And you don't want to ever regret anything.
Fair.
I was like, look, and so that's the story. Mm-hmm. And jumped in and joined in, 2018.
So you joined Cresco 2018 when?
Q4.
Q4. Okay, so right at the end of 18.
Yeah, so just before we went public.
Oh, nice. Okay, so you've been with the company, 19, 20? So it's 3 years now, basically.
Yeah. Gosh. Nice. Feels longer than that, but yes, yeah. That's the number.
three cannabis years. I mean, it's a different story, right?
Yeah.
But so I just want to back up a couple things you said, right? That was really interesting. So, because I think, from even being investors in the cannabis industry, we always talk about, this idea, this light at the end of the tunnel of, uplisting. And when uplisting happens, it gives permission for all the other industries, all the big, the big board industries to come into our sector, right? Mm-hmm. And some of them are already finding a way in through these creative structures. But for the most part, it hasn't happened yet. So it's really interesting to hear you say that at, a large beer company, they're actively studying cannabis as a competitive threat and looking at, how it's going to impact their portfolio.
Yeah. And that's in the US. And then clearly, if you look at all the big, particularly beer, most also have actually taken an investment stance in cannabis, just in Canada, where they can, right? So I'm pretty sure I'm a little bit out of touch of the roster, but Molson Coors, has got a position in Hexo.
Yep. They've got the JV with Hexo. So it's more of not really an investment, but they've got something, right? Yep.
Constellation and Canopy.
Yeah. Which I'm sure they're thrilled about.
ABI, no comment. ABI, and I'm blanking on where their investment is.
I don't know if AnBev has a investment. I
think through maybe their venture fund they do. I'm not sure. And then Boston Beer has its team that they put up in Canada.
Oh, I didn't know that one, but I know Pabst, PBR has that spinoff company that's like they don't own any of. But like it's the same kind of people doing it, and they're actually using the Pabst brand, I think, in California.
Yeah, Pabst is an interesting one, mostly because that, for the most part, I believe, and this is now years ago, and I was working in beer, Pabst really has turned into, they've really gotten out of a lot of their manufacturing footprint, have become more of a licensing company for that brand. Mm-hmm. So whether you're licensing it into beer and having someone else manufacture it for it, or license it, it's that brand and that company is a little bit different from everyone else. But the point being, not only are for sure companies talking about it internally, but they are also actively figuring out how do they stay on the pulse of it through Canada and through CBD investments, right? So even, it's impressed. Molson Coors has got a really cool looking CBD brand that they are slowly bringing in to the US through some of their distributor partners in Colorado and other markets. So everyone is like maybe not talking about it openly, but if you look at actions and the little actions that are happening everywhere, you're like each one of these little actions creates a learning opportunity for these companies without them having to overly talk about an industry, which is really hard for them to talk about because of its federal regulation.
So that's my next question, right? Is what does it take for these guys to actually make the jump into US, like plant touching type of stuff? Is it because they could do it right now today using like a convert structure like Tilray did, right? So what does it actually take for them? Do you, you know, and just in your opinion, based on sitting in the room, what does it take for this group of people to actually start doing the U.S. operations?
Yeah, so this is now 100% personal opinion. So not based on anything from previous career or insider and knowledge on it. I think it is going to be when it's easy to do growth. Sorry, easy to like achieve growth out of the investment. And right now, I think the risk reward and the complexity reward isn't quite there to take it on. And so I think what I think they're waiting on is, first of all, someone has to go first, which typically happens in all CPG, right? It's like there's a first mover and then quickly all sorts of dominoes. And I think that really did also happen with all the investment up in Canada, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, yep.
You know, Constellation went first and then quickly everyone was put on guard and did something.
Yep.
So I think the investment here is going to come into when it is the risk reward is there. Like, I don't think anyone's right now with federal regulations that are going to overly do a complex thing in the US that could potentially lead to some sort of like risk to the core business.
Got it. So sorry, when you say risk reward isn't there, because clearly there's a lot of reward, right? You're talking about growth. And
the, I just think that the risk profile is too big to the core, like risk relative to the core business.
So nobody wants to put their neck on the line and say, hey, let's do this big jump. And then, you know, if the feds come knocking, you know,
this has been the stance of a lot of, media companies and other service providers, which is, and even like, you know, question we used to get back in 2019, which is, are you working with any big agencies? And I'm like, you know, anyone who is publicly traded is probably eager to accept cannabis money, but can't. And, you know, and some can because they're either privately owned or something like that. But when you look at, well, how much can cannabis afford is going to bring into us from revenue, vis-a-vis what risk that might cause to other clients, to our holding company, to you name it, it usually gets into the industry and how much the industry is spending in this case isn't worth the risk of getting in at this point.
Got it. So when you say risk, that's what you're talking about, the risk to the mothership and, you know.
And so I think, you know, then if it becomes, look, if there is like a green light, you know, here's what I look at cannabis holistically is it's a lot of growth. As we talked about, we started this conversation with, like, it's decades of growth ahead of us. That's pretty attractive to any company that is facing potential challenging or anemic growth prospects ahead of it, right?
No doubt.
Right. So that has to be weighing. Like, when you look at some of these companies, just how much capital they have and their need to deploy that capital to support growth, you can quickly look at cannabis and be like, it's not our core business, but there's a lot of tangentials here. And it's got just years of growth ahead of it, whereas our core business may not.
And
that is the, you know, once it becomes less risky for the big, once someone makes the first move, the investment rationale on that level is pretty easy.
Then it's like, hey, it's like we have to do it just to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah. And that typically, this is way outside of beer. I think that's mostly, if you look at it, if zoom out on all CPG industries, whatever becomes like the trend du jour, and when one of the big players jumps on it quickly, the other ones follow suit.
Got it.
And that was true in, you know, wellness CPG. That's true in food. That's true in retail.
Hard seltzers.
Yeah. Alcohol, hard seltzers. Like, you know, once there's a trend, whether or not everyone wants to get into it or not, you usually kind of all follow suit. So I think that that's what's going to take to move it. Cause I think everyone's looking at it and be like, the growth is interesting. We know how to, you know, there's lots of this industry we don't know how to do, but there's lots about this industry that we would bring value to. Our cost of capital would be much cheaper. We can invest a lot more into it to help it continue to grow. And it gets us growth.
And so, you know, we touched on this earlier, so it's a good time to get back to it. You know, you mentioned that the way the cannabis industry is evolving, in some ways you're starting to see it, like some similarities to alcohol. So I'd love for you to expand on that a little bit and just talk about the differences in general between cannabis and alcohol.
I was going to say, I think it's more, it's evolving into, if you zoom out and actually think about the consumer, not just the industry, but like who's consuming,
okay,
what's evolving into, it's just becoming very normal to be part of occasions that are, you know, what I would say are core occasions to the alcohol industry. So a lot of growth, you know, each different alcohol company has its own segmentation on just how do you think about consumers, right? Because if you think of you and I, we consume lots of different brands every day for lots of different reasons. And there's no one brand that fulfills all of my different needs. And how we used to think about it before, both in alcohol, but also, you know, we worked with all the big consulting firms like BCG and Bain, and I think McKinsey have their own versions of this, where they, you segment the market and you look at it based on like, you're not fighting for a consumer because no one brand can ever own one consumer 100%. What you're fighting for is for the occasion, which you think you win in, how do you own that occasion? And then how do you keep either extending that brand in occasions or building more brands so you keep winning more and more and more of the occasions that consumers have?
Well, sorry, what are some examples of these occasions?
Yeah, it's like, look at your day. Like you wake up, one occasion is like, what's your morning routine?
Okay.
Coffee? Like you need a stimulant, like that's an occasion. It's a Thursday, and
so if you're a coffee or a tea brand, that morning wake up occasion is really, really important.
Yeah, and that subsegments into, is it the at home prep or is it the on the go prep? Like, and then those work. Are different occasions. And then if you double click into that, you're like, well, that there's different needs. Like it's still breakfast, but if you're a food company, you're like, well, this is what I do for at home. And then whether I'm food or quick service restaurants, here's how I think about winning the on-the-go breakfast occasion. And the same with like alcohol. Like think of all the different reasons you consume. Like some of them might be to impress. You're going out for a drink after work. Well, when we used to be able to do that. With colleagues and friends, and you don't know them. And I used to, you know, this was very true to the Miller Lite days of like, I've got diehard Miller Lite consumers, but when you're out with people you don't really know and it's for more of a sophisticated occasion, you choose an import. It may not even be your favorite beer, but you're choosing it because it feels like the right thing to do for that special moment.
Right.
Versus I'm at home and I'm like relaxing and I'm drinking my favorite beer. Or I've got friends over and it's especially like all those little things, like all these little moments are all very much part of our daily ritual. But when you look at those, you start to realize there's different needs that are coming to life. And as a marketer, and actually look, as any CPG company, I don't think it's marketing because, you know, building brands goes way beyond the marketing department. It's about how do you understand, first of all, which of these occasions have the most volume potential for you.
Okay.
And then what is the needs that, you know, your patient or your consumer has in that occasion? And then how do I build my product, my value proposition, my brand, whatever you want to call it, to really win and own that occasion? That's what great brands figure out how to do.
That's fascinating. So let's just take exactly kind of, you know, running through somebody's day. Can we take that now and apply it to cannabis and Cresco and how you guys think about that?
Yeah. Like, I think, you know, we don't have that much time to go through like every part of the day part, but like, let's just go like, there's, you know, morning consumption, on the way to work. It's maybe about helping with my anxiety. It's maybe just helped me as a stimulant to get going. Like it's very much kind of wellness and just helping me feel better to kick off my day.
Okay.
Like that's an occasion. And, you know, we've built some of our brands to go at like to really play the occasion. Like that's either a Cresco liquid live resin. It is portable because that's important because you're kind of on the go. It's discreet. And it helps depending on what strain and what variant you're looking for, helps you deal with kind of the need you're having. And its real purpose is not to like get high and escape. Its real purpose is to help me. It's like wellness, health and wellness.
Right.
So that's an occasion. And then, you know, we think about kind of, there is also times of out with friends and you may be drinking and socializing and you're there and, you know, alcohol could be a play. You know, it's the consumer's choice. We never condone, you know, multi-use, but I'm like, hey, consumer's doing it. And you're like, I don't really want it. Like I'm still drinking a little bit, but I don't want to drink too much. And you know, that's where we're seeing microdosing is coming into play, right? Which is like, taking it in between consumption, and I kind of want to be fun. And that's where, you know, we build like Wonder Minis or Mini Mints. Like, they're portable, they're discreet, they're mm-hmm. small, they're microdosed, and they're fun. Like, they're, you know, we want to laugh, as you know, many people in the company call like gigglers, because they really make you have like a good time. And it's a compliment to that social occasion. And then there's just, you know, my chill out zen. Like, I want to just escape. And it's me time. And, you know, that's, it can be like a heavy flower consumer, where you're enjoying the whole process. It's not just about like vaping a pen quickly to be discreet or taking it discreet. Like, you're the magic of consuming cannabis, of looking at enjoying the flower, grinding, rolling, like,
or like a concentrator, a dab, right? So something that's a lot harder to do on the go or outside, but
or you're with friends who all share a similar, probably a similar tolerance, and you can all like enjoy hanging out. And using a concentrator, dabbing, and like, so each one of those, but again, that same consumer who might dab when they're with their buddies who are like all have equal tolerance, our concentrates work for that occasion, but they may not be dabbing when they wake up first thing in the morning, right. And they'd much prefer more discreet on the go, and that's where our live resin comes into play. So it's just about, it starts with just like figuring out, and that's the puzzle of like, what are these occasions that are like, are worth it to invest in, that are meaningful to our patients and consumers? What do they need? Like, what are they looking for? And then how do we just build superior products that do that better than we think anyone else?
And when you say, you know, you're going to invest in a product for an occasion, okay, so you could think about it, you design a product like liquid live resin, for example, right? And maybe certain strains, you're like, hey, these are great, you know, daytime wake up strains, right? For LLR. But then what does it actually look like? Like how does it go from you designing it and producing it to actually, you know, getting it in the consumer's hands and educating them that this is how we, you know, this is a fit for this.
Yeah. And I think like, look, I don't think it's not like this is perfect math of you do occasion then you build. It's just more of understanding. It's really understanding like what are consumer needs you're trying to address. Right. Mm. And that, cause it's not, none of these things are mutually exclusive. Like, it doesn't mean that one brand is only designed for like, but it's more about it serves a need.
Got it.
Cause I think one of the great things about our liquid live resin formula is if you enjoy flower, like it is, but you need, whether it's discretion or portability or whatever, it's pretty darn close. It's as close to the real thing as you can get from an experience perspective. And so that brand can meet multiple occasions, but it stands for that. So I think kind of your question is like, how do we think about it? Which is, well, okay, if I know what needs are, then how do I, and you know, our operations team and cultivation team and manufacturing team and kitchens team spent a lot of time doing this, was like, how do you create perfect formulations for those occasions? And then as from a communications perspective and marketing, how do we tell it to consumers? And right now with where the industry is, a lot of that has to happen on social, and a lot of that has to happen through word of mouth, and a lot of it predominantly has to happen at point of purchase in stores.
Right. So bud tender marketing is pretty key in all this.
Yep. Absolutely. In-store marketing is key to every consumer good. Like there's a great book out there, and of course I'm blanking on its name, but it's like, it's about how brands grow. And it's basically a PhD that looked at and really studied, not theory on I liked that brand, not I liked that campaign or I liked that package. It was like empirical data that's like brand growth correlated to sales. Like, how do brands grow? And it, you know, it is, it's in a, it, there's a lot of great case studies. I've seen it play out multiple times in my own business when you know what to look for. And what it looks at is like, you have to, from building your brands, you have two things that are just so important. One is that you're standing for something that is meaningful to the consumer, and you repeat it over and over and over again. Because, you know, as much as marketers, we love to think that consumers are thinking about our brands every single day. They think about it a microsecond. And so just kind of getting that microsecond of attention and having a repetitive message works. And then it's availability in stores. And those two things are necessary. Always play out on how on what's driving growth of successful brands.
The customer needs to think about it. It needs to, whatever that moment is, and they're deciding, that needs to come to the top of the mind. And then also when they go to the store, it has to be there.
Yeah, and I think he used the term mental availability and physical availability. Mental availability being like you've somehow found a way to get a consumer to think about you, which is super hard and getting harder every day as we keep getting more and more and more and more messages inundated on us. And then physical availability, even if you think about it, it's got to be available. Like you got to be able to buy it wherever you shop. And one of the key tenets in his book is like if you think. Loyalty, I think he has a great quote, and if I'm remembering, it's like, if you want loyalty, it's not coming from a brand to get a dog. and I think that's true in consumers. I think consumers always have a roster of brands that they will consider, but it is always a jump ball at the moment of truth or, point of purchase, like when you actually buy.
And we see this
in beer, right? Like we have Miller Lite consumers, but my Miller Lite consumers also will consume a Bud Light and a Ultra or a Corona. So you're in the decision set. So good. But it doesn't mean I guarantee that purchase. And that's why when you go in these stores and you see so much energy and creativity and passion put into in-store displays. And I think they call them power alleys and all these other things. It's really because it's like, look, I know I got a 1 in 4 chance you're going to pick me. So I just want to be the brand that when you're in there at closest to the register, I re-pull something back from your mind, which is like, ooh, I like Cresco. And oh, here's a display of Cresco. And hey, this budtender, wellness advisor is talking to me about Cresco. Great. I'm going to get the sale. And so that's how we think about it.
And so let's dig in a little bit. So what is a brand in cannabis?
I think a brand in cannabis is a brand that exists anywhere. It's no different. And brands exist for us to help us make decisions. Full stop. Like that's why brands exist.
Exist to consumers.
Consumers, yep. And it helps you make a decision because there's so much choice out there, and a brand is a little bit of like an encapsulation of information that just helps you make a decision. And then brands also service you in two fronts, which is like what we call kind of the functional benefit of the brand is I really like the taste, the experience. And then also the emotional benefit of a brand, which is I like associating myself with it because this brand seems to share values that I like and I connect with it. It's not a rational decision, right? You're like, this is an inanimate object. How can you be associating yourself with it? But it carries all these things with it that you want to badge yourself with.
It's so funny. As you're saying this, I'm just laughing to myself because I'm like, every time I tour like a really badass facility of a company, I'm like, you guys need to give me some merch. Like, I want to wear,
right?
There's this emotional connection of like, I'm so impressed. I want to wear this logo because like, there's a connection there.
Yeah. And I know you want a sweatshirt. I gave you t-shirts and stuff, but like, we'll keep going.
Hoodies. Come on. I want the good stuff.
Right. But that's like, again, when you're in the world of rational thinking, you're like, I can get a hoodie anywhere. I probably have lots of hoodies, but I do want this other brand's hoodie because I want to badge myself with it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So that's from a brand perspective. So what does it mean? That's what brands I think mean in general. So in cannabis, I don't think it means that much different, right? It's like one is particularly as all markets become just more competitive, consumers are going to have a lot more choice. And one of the roles of a brand is that when I'm staring at a menu or I'm being, scrolling through a online menu, which brand do I want? I see a lot. And what we need to do as marketers is kind of like when they see our brand, it says something that's meaningful to them because we got to help people make decisions and pick us. And then, so that's really what brands exist for. And then on one hand, and then the other two parts is functionally, you have to have a superior experience with our products. Like you feel it, taste it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then emotionally, we got to make you, feel like you want a hoodie. You want to become a poster child for our brand. So that's what brands do. And I think if you look at cannabis, you're like, brands are only going to grow in this industry and they'll grow in, as we talked about before, very differently depending on the category. So I don't think it's like a one size fit all here. Because one, brands will help consumers make choice. Two, if brands are helping consumers make choice, it will help dispensaries limit SKU proliferation and drive efficiencies in their stores. Right now, I think we got a lot of, because if you have a lot of brands, I think there's, you know, what's it called? The paradox of choice. Mm-hmm. I think everyone thinks everyone wants a lot of brands.
Right.
But I don't think consumers do. I think actually consumers like actually even be easier with fewer brands.
Yeah, it can be too much sometimes.
Right. And then from a dispensary, like that's a lot of working capital. That's a lot of like complexity in the back end to manage all those brands. So I think, you know, we're going to see consumers start to hopefully here pick fewer brands because they just don't want all that choice. And then it'll also, customers will support that because it should drive some efficiencies on how they run their stores.
So let's talk about for a second the idea of choice and brands and competition, okay? Because I think this is really important. So, you know, you look at a market like California where amazing product selection, you know, it's fantastic if you're a consumer. The prices are very reasonable for the most part. And, you know, I was in a dispensary right before MJ Biz, and it was like, it really in California, I mean, and it felt, I was surprised when you look at two or three different dispensaries, you know, a lot of these dispensaries have completely different products. And it struck me to be like a lot like Canada, where you have these great products, you have great prices for consumers, but it seems extremely fragmented and hard for anybody to actually make any money.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think California is really hard. It's such an important market for so many reasons. It is such a difficult market. And I think one of the challenges in the market is it's too much. It's too much choice. Mm-hmm. And again, it is a known thing, like paradox of choice, which is like if you show consumers too much, it actually can be overwhelming and it can lead to them potentially buying less versus a more simplified menu. And the second thing, it's like it's also, I think, really hard on the dispensary owner. I think whether they realize it or not, the cost of carrying all that is there's cost there. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is like, it also, from a building a brand perspective, it makes it really hard because we go back to what we were discussing before. Like, you know, if I gotta be able to get your attention, but also be always available for you wherever you want, you know, the assortment of these stores changes over so frequently. And it changes over so frequently because you have so many different suppliers that either have supply consistently or just people buying and you know, bulk repackaging it in their own brand and selling it. And so it comes in, but then they can't sustain that. So it goes out. And like, there's a stability that is going to be necessary for California just for anyone to make money. I think, you know, I unfortunately you're hearing a lot of that right now with where the market is and prices are, is just, you know, and I was on a call with our head of public affairs in the state, in government affairs in the state, and she was just like, look, you're hearing these stories of people passing in their keys to grow. They're just like, and so that is going to bring a lot of consolidation and restructuring to the market. It's really hard for everyone in that space. The one thing, though, it will start to restructure probably stores. And I think that does create an opportunity for players to start building their brands, because I think smaller assortment can be good. I don't think it's like five brands, by the way. It's like, it's a lot of different SKUs. It's just not as many as we have today. And I actually think that can be okay for the consumer, but it's really, really, really good for folks that are trying to build a brand and that have consistent supply, because if you can get in there and people like your product and they're buying it and you can supply it, and you've got dispensaries who are not tempted to buy, you know, the flavor du jour that then goes away, you can start to have consistent availability in your store, and that helps you to start build a brand.
So let me ask you this, right? Going back to the alcohol analogy, because, you know, when I go to pick up, you know, a bottle of red wine, right? And I know nothing about wine, but when I go to pick up a bottle of red wine, I'll sort of just pick whatever, maybe it has a cool label, it's a reasonable price. I don't fuss too much about what it is I'm getting. But when I go to get vodka, I drink, you know, I want Tito's. And if they don't have Tito's, I want Kettle One. And if they don't have Kettle One, it goes like, you know, it drops off pretty fast. So It's just interesting thinking about that to me, that because I don't know why that is, but for alcohol, I'm very brand particular. In mm-hmm. wine, I sort of don't really care. I'll take what I can get, right? So which one is cannabis? Is it more like spirits or more like wine?
I don't know if that's – I don't – again, I kind of look at it as like, is that the right question, or is it what type of consumers are you going to have?
Okay.
Right, because I could have the same argument of you. Mm-hmm. I much prefer wine to spirits.
Okay.
So like vodka, I'm like, as long as it's not super cheap, I'm going to get a headache. I'm okay with whatever you pick. Wine, I've got a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. and I have lots of, red, white starting point. Then go into varietals, then go into regions, then go into price points, then go into if you want blends or not. Like, I have a lot of questions. So I think you're going to have consumers in cannabis that are like, this is just fun. And I just want to enjoy this weekend. So I'm going to go in and ask for whatever they recommend. And I'll buy it. And that's fun. Just like you do with wine.
Sure.
But you're going to have consumers like me who are like, I am coming in. I may have a couple of brands that I know are fire, but I'm looking for the coolest, newest strain that's hitting. And I'm going to try that. And I know everything about it. I can talk to you about terpenes. I'm going to like review like all of it. And so I think, what cannabis is going to have is different degrees of knowledgeable consumers, just like the analogy you described.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how brands are going to start to be built, is about understanding, again, who are those consumers, what is the occasion, and what are their needs. And I think, there's a lot of people out there who would argue that flower is a little bit more akin to the wine industry, where, you're going to have a couple of brands that you trust. Maybe there's a couple brands, and this was the head of marketing at Bluma when we acquired them. And he came from the wine industry, and he was pretty passionate about this point, which is like, I think you're also going to see, just like in wine, a couple of manufacturers that might be just known for a specific strain or type.
Mm.
That's what they do. And then others that are just known for good quality, but offer lots of different varietals. And I think wine and flower are comparable, if anything. I still think it comes down to it's a consumer thing. It's not really, and that's the right way to think about it. Like, you'll have knowledgeable consumers, not knowledgeable consumers, frequent consumers, infrequent consumers, all with different needs. But if you're trying to push the analogy closer to alcohol, I think flower looks more like wine because of just the varietals and the joy of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think manufactured goods looks a little bit more like CPG, where there's a couple of brands that are just consistently, you enjoy consistently and you want that. But then I think even within that, I think in edibles, for example, you got to look like CPG, but you got to look like a confectionery CPG, which is... which I think is pretty known. 50%, 50, 60% of sales tend to come from like four core SKUs.
Hmm.
And then the other majority come from in and out innovation. That's fun and exciting. That keeps people kind of trying your brand.
And so going back to flower for a second, it's interesting to hear you say that, because how you are with wine is how I am with flower.
Mm-hmm.
Where I want to try, I want to try the new strain. I want to try the new thing. I want, I'm going to scrutinize it very closely and look at the bud and not only bag appeal, but effects and taste and terps and all that kind of stuff. Right. But so how do you guys balance? Because, a lot of scaled cultivators, they get these strains, they dial them in, they select for yield and potency and bag appeal. And then, it's kind of hard to bring in a new variety, right? Because you got to readjust for all those things, but you sacrifice on your yield. So how does Cresco think about that and balance those things?
It is unbelievably impressive to go work with our cultivation team of like just the science, how they're approaching it, how they're thinking about it, and how they're approaching it without giving out too much of our insider information is there are going to be brands in our portfolio that are designed around those things. Like, we will offer a limited grow, limited drop brand that is high potency, unique terp profile, hand trimmed. And we will put that in, and it'll have its role and its price point that you're paying for that. And then we'll have other brands like High Supply, mm-hmm. where we're focused on, you know, it could have great strains of what's coming available, but it really is focused on giving you the best value for the price.
Got it.
And so I think that's where brands start to define themselves. Like, what is your job? Like, what do you do? And I'm like, what I think is I struggle with, and I know some of our competitors are taking this approach. It might work. I think just looking at the CPG industry in general, I would tell you it's tough. Is I do not believe that brands have to stand for something, mm-hmm. and I do not believe that they can stretch too far. And what I mean by that is I think it's really hard for a brand to stretch across price points.
Hmm.
So playing high-low is really hard because you always have the risk of, well, is the high price one really that much better? So if they're offering a lower price one and it's materially less off, but it's significantly expensive, I'm going to shift down. And then I think it can be hard for brands to play across too many categories. Hmm. And so we're figuring that out. It's like, where can you go? Can a flower brand go into concentrate?
Right.
You know,
because right now, talking about Cresco, all your brands do play across different segments, right? Cresco, High Supply.
Yeah, Cresco and High Supply, and that is in the inhalable. So like, that's the question we've looked at. Was like, yeah, I think we think inhalable brands can.
Got it.
And you know, in California, we've launched FloraCal, which is our premium brand, in both premium flower and premium vape. So the inhalable category, we think it can.
Okay.
Right now, harder to think about how it goes into like edibles.
Hmm.
So that's, you know, that's something we're figuring out, right? As we look to consumers and how they're buying, and look to how we either build, partner, or buy a new brand, it is trying to figure out, is that product delivering against the need of the consumer, and is one of those needs, again, emotional or rational, that the consumer just doesn't think that a known flower brand should be in a vape brand, or vice versa. And we're figuring out that if that's a real need for consumers or not.
And so one of the things that Cresco, I think, has differentiated itself, and it's a strategy I didn't like earlier on and I'm kind of warming up to, is this idea of being the middle of the value chain, mm-hmm. where, you know, so retail and cultivation can be commoditized, and we want to be in the middle, right? We want to be the brand, we want to be the distribution. And, you know, Cresco prides itself on being the leading wholesaler in the industry, right? So my question is, you know, given the importance, you know, you mentioned availability of product, and we didn't talk about it, but consistency of product. And I have to give you guys a lot of credit, because like, if I look at the core markets like Illinois and Pennsylvania, Cresco is doing, in my opinion, one of the best jobs in delivering high quality consistency at scale, mm-hmm. on flower, LLR, concentrate, right? But so my question to you is, how can you, how in the future do you get away from the cultivation? Like, it seems to me like the cultivation is kind of intertwined with the brand and the product quality.
I feel like Charlie has set you up for this question, like a perfect setup. So I think I'll unpack your question a couple ways. One is, when we talk about, and you know, when they founded the company, we're going to focus on the middle two verticals of the value chain. I think that got maybe taken too literal of like, mm-hmm. they're only focusing on that.
Okay.
Our point is, we are a company that wants to be here for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And as you look at the future of this industry, future, not just this year, this quarter, this year, future, we fundamentally believe that there will be more retailers out there than there are today.
Hmm.
That is our belief. We think that the states will continue to issue retail licenses, and that markets will become more competitive with retailers.
So to be clear, you're saying the thesis is, over time, the regulations regarding retail will open up.
Yep. And so you will be in a market that there will be more retail, more competition on the retail phase. May not be, and you know, I think the team started talking about that pre going public at the beginning of the company. So years and years ago, which was, and it's playing out like from where we were back then. which is there's more stores in Florida, vertically integrated, but a lot more stores.
True. Yep.
California has, who knows, it's always hard to get a perfect count, but like 650 to 700 doors in California.
Mm.
It's a lot.
But that seems really underbuilt for California.
For sure. And I think it's going to continue to grow as you can make money there. Michigan, Illinois, like where we know the state has the right to open up more stores, like hundreds. Mm. Massachusetts, hundreds. New York, when it comes online, you know, magic ball of what's going to happen there. But like, there will be a lot of stores. So when we say that, it's like, all we're saying is our vision of the future is there is going to be a lot of competition of points of distribution, doors, stores, dispensaries, whatever you want to call them.
Delivery.
Yeah, delivery. Delivery in the future. So what
that future could be like relatively far away.
Maybe, but we made the statement, you know, 5 years ago, and every quarter, you know, seemed like you could have said that about Massachusetts 4 quarters ago, and now all of a sudden they've really ramped up what's approving out there and how many doors are going to open. Mm-hmm. Illinois, if we can get through kind of the current regulations issue, a lot more doors. So it's not that far. So that was more of a statement of like, because we know that's coming, we want to make sure that we are building capabilities, we are building brands, and we are building our back end operations cultivation to support that we can play in every door that comes out in the market. And that's been, you know, I know Charlie talks about it all the time. That is his big thesis. But I'll remind you, like we are a, you know, and we're not the largest by any means, but we are a darn damn, whatever you want to say, good retailer. Like in our last earnings call, our productivity is really good. We open, you know, we are the highest share in Illinois and we're capped. Now we'll always try to find a way, how do we maximize that? But we're capped, right? We got all doors. Like and that's where I think when everyone talks to me about the middle, I'm like, I think you guys are taking it a little bit too literal. And I think it feel like it's a bit of, and I get it. It's a way to help define what makes each one of us unique.
Mm-hmm.
But as we talked before, you know, 40% of our revenue comes from retail.
And so to that point about retail, okay, in the future, it's going to get more competitive. And like, to be fair, I mean, you go visit any dispensary, like I even to this point now almost don't bother visiting a lot of dispensaries when I go, because if you have the location on a map and you pull up Google Maps, that's 90% of what you need to know, like it's, mm-hmm. and the menu online. Like, but inside the store, it's retail, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. not that different store to store. But the cultivation is super different. Cultivation to cultivation. It's very differentiated, right?
Yep.
So to your point though, okay, retail can get commoditized, but in that same world where we're opening up, you know, the licensing structure, can't grow licenses also be issued? Can't we have way more, you know, cultivation as well, which then devalues your cultivation?
For sure. Absolutely. It devalues your cultivation. And I feel like we got in this long debate last time and it took us like an hour of a conversation because it can, if you let it, like it will come. Like, assume this, it's going to come. I have to say, in this industry, looking forward, what can we agree on? If you are a retail only focused company, you are going to face more competition.
Right.
Because it will come. And if you're in your cultivation, you're going to face more competition because new licenses will be issued. So that's given. So then on the retail side, it's mm-hmm. okay. If more retailers are going to come, and they're likely going to become, you know, I think states are going to try to figure out how they ensure that it's not all owned by MSOs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Then I need to make sure that I'm building really, really amazing brands, products to deserve to be on your shelf and have an amazing backbone, that we're a great partner, that we not only give you great products, but we're easy to do business with. And we talk about it inside us is like, be the partner of choice. Even to our MSO partners. And how do we do that? And it's an ongoing journey. There's things that we're doing well, there's things that we got to improve. But that is kind of our North Star on that, because we're like, it is going to come. And so I want not only my brands in there, I want my brands to pull in there. I want to be their partner of choice. That's how I will defend against the growth in retail and the competition in cultivation that will come. Is be better at it than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
as you said, some are better, some are not as good. Like, I think, you know, Ty and Drew and Todd and on our team on the op side would love you for saying thank you. It is really hard to get quality cannabis at scale in every state every day. Is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And they work really hard to make that happen. That is something we're going to keep investing on and trying to figure out how to do, so we do it better. And if we can't do it better, then I think the realities are, as long as you've built those brands that have access to those doors, then if it does become more of a commodity marketplace where you can, you know, determine spot pricing, when do you want to make versus when do you want to buy, and you can buy from someone else. Well, the good news is you've got the brands that they go into, and you have the relationships of the points of access that enable your brand to be sold through. So we're building for the future to help ensure that we are defending ourselves against what I do. It's inevitable.
So on that, you know, point about thinking about the future and commoditization, right? One of, I think a very legitimate criticism of the industry or negative of the industry has been, as we saw in Q3 and we're probably seeing going forward, we're seeing more pricing discount and markets flipping from being just really undersupplied and every gram flies off the shelf to now, you know, in Florida, we saw a price war. In PA, we're seeing increasing discounting. Even in Illinois now, as we wait for more stores, I'm seeing more discounting popping up, you know, more spot discounting, but still even popping up. Is that something we as investors should be worried about?
Yes and no, I guess. Yes, in that depending on what your investment horizon is.
Okay.
Right. Like in the short term, there is a lot of price compression happening. California, I think it's, you know, it's oversupplied, but that's going to over time work itself out. So that's probably an interim right now problem, maybe not a future problem. And then in markets like Pennsylvania, I really do think it is driven by, you've got players like us bringing increased supply online in advance of adult use, mm-hmm. right? So bringing more supply onto a medical market. So as that market changes, that will once again change the dynamic. So I think right now where we are a little bit is just in core markets, there's oversupply. And either that oversupply is going to structurally work itself out, like I think is going to happen in California, or it's just a short-term imbalance between when an adult use market is coming online versus when canopy has been built. And then,
so that maybe applies in like PA, right, where it could mm-hmm. go rec. And by the way, do you guys have a opinion on if we're going to get rec in the next legislative session or what's going
to
happen?
Not a question for me. That'd be a question. Yeah. Dr. Charlie and Sully on Sullivan on your next podcast.
Okay. Fair enough.
I hope it's soon, but you just asked them.
Fair enough. Okay. But so one of the problems that I see is, like, you know, you go, okay, rationalization, right? So California, for example, people fail, right? It just, they can't deal with the price competition anymore. As you said earlier, they come and give back the keys, right? So supply constricts, and that's what helps rationalize the market over time. But, you know, when you talk about limited licensed operators and like Illinois, Florida, PA, it does, like, nobody's going to fail, it seems like. It just seems like people are going to say, well, we're just going to, like, it just seems everyone's incentivized to keep pumping out the maximum amount of supply and not tamp down their supply. So I just worry about, okay, then you just have, you know, the supply problem doesn't fix itself, so it's hard to ever be rationalized other than by prices dropping. And even prices dropping, like, how much more volume are you getting out of the med patients?
Again, I think you're absolutely correct. Now, don't forget, on the back end, you take a utilization charge if you're building too much and you can't sell it through. So at some point, you just can't, you got to stop and slow it down and hold if you think that adult use is on a longer horizon.
Got it.
But okay. I think, you know, your question, like, how long? Well, if it is, prices will go down, and you've got to believe that the lean players can weather that storm. But I do believe it's a storm, because the unlean players will not be able to weather the storm, and it's going to look like California, which unfortunately some people have to get back their keys. But then we have so many growth drivers in the market that it should open it up. But I think in the cannabis industry in general, like, the challenge, and you tell me if it's similar in Canada, is like there's a lot of capital flowing in. Mm-hmm. So everyone's able to build. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier right now to build to where the demand in the market is. And so I think we're just in a moment right now of flux. I think the big players are building for big catalyst changes in demand, so they'll be fine, and but might play with pricing in the short term until that happens. And I think the real hard part is for the smaller players that may not be fine, because just there will be price compression and they may not have the cost structure behind it to support that.
So talking about key drivers, right? How do you see financially, what are the key drivers for Cresco in 22 and 23?
This is a question about brand building. Podcast. I think you duped me into this by talking about, we're going to talk about brands, and quite quickly you've moved on to a analyst call.
Exactly. Please give us your projections.
Been trained to not give that. Look, I think the big drivers for us is not anything different than what we talk about on our call.
Okay.
Which is we are very focused on continuing to get more out of our core markets. And increasing that share in core markets. And then the other component for us is through, you've seen some of the deals, which is expanding. And I said, we don't get a lot of credit for a retail all the time, but we've got a pretty good retailer that we're expanding. And that is going to drive incremental growth for us in markets like Pennsylvania, in markets like Florida. So we are excited because we've got some really amazing, exciting innovation that's coming online in our core markets.
Okay.
That will help us take share. We're thrilled about. And we've got...
Can you talk about that innovation?
On the next podcast, I can.
Okay. TBD.
I can talk about that when this thing's going live.
We'll put a pin in that.
That'll be chapter two. Okay. And then in non-core markets, like a Michigan, like our facility's just coming online in 2022.
Right.
So that's going to give us new opportunities. And then with what we've done in PA and where we get to go in Florida, that just gives us brand new markets to play in. So that, as I look at kind of the next year, is what is interesting in our growth story.
Got it. Okay, fair enough. And then talking about, you know, Cresco and you know, one of the things that, so I spent a bunch of time with the team and saw some facilities when I was in Chicago, and that was really, really helpful. And that helped me realize kind of exactly what you're talking about, building the business for the long term, being a products company that resonate with consumers. And look, it's undeniable, right? You go to a dispensary, you buy a couple eights, and Cresco eights, in my opinion, are some of the best. They have the consistency. They have a variety of strains. They come out really frosty. Like it's very impressive what you guys are doing. So I guess my question is, you know, what gave me pause is on the financial side, because the margins are, you know, decently lower than your peers who you started at the same time with. You have a very similar footprint to from the early days, at least. So I guess I'm trying to reconcile these two things, right? You've got a company that's doing really well on the product side, doing really well on retail, as we talked about, and yet the margins are lower than its peers. So can we talk about why that is?
Again, invite me on a call to talk about kind of what we're doing with our innovation pipeline. I feel like I got duped. Here's what I will talk to you about. And it's not that different from what Dennis would be sharing as well.
Okay.
There is some structural differences previous year to current year of retail size of revenue. Like retail does give you absolute better margin because you're getting the wholesale plus a retail markup.
Okay.
And so we were at a bit of a structural difference of how many doors did we have opened versus our peers, and we've caught that up one. And so that's going to help. Two is we made some investments that, you know, I think if you looked at our last earnings report, I think a lot of investors were very pleased with what they saw on improvement. And I think that's you seeing that we are starting to get operational leverage, which, you know, we feel good about. I think some of our peers may have to invest to get their pieces caught up.
Okay.
And then I think three, you know, we talked about it also in our last call, like the decision in California was tough for us. Like we're proud of what the team out there was able to build with some of the partner brands. But at the end of the day, what we've always said is it cannot just be hollow revenue. Like it has to be profitable revenue that makes it worth it. And, you know, having to move off those was a tough decision, but it will, it was lower margin revenue. So when you think of just how that flows through your financial statements, that has an impact. vis-a-vis our peers who don't have that same exposure out of California. So those decisions, you know, growth in our retail footprint, continued innovation, and investments we're making to help with our costs of operations, and then getting real operational leverage, are things that are helping us continue to show improvement, which, you know, you just saw in the last earnings report.
And to be fair, like, you know, to your credit, like the margin you guys are guiding to for Q4, that margin improvement, it's, I mean, my guess is it's unlikely we're going to see that kind of jump for your peers going into Q4.
You know, again, in the spirit of kind of, you know, who should be opining on this, your next podcast should be with Dennis on that.
Okay, fair enough.
And he can probably give you a strong position. Like, I don't want to pontificate on my peers and what they are or not doing. I would just say from, you know, if I was an investor looking at us, the story I would take away from Cresco Labs is, okay, you guys have been generating, as you said, good products, good top line, wholesale revenue, and now we're seeing your investments start to kick in operational leverage, which is nice to see.
Got it. Fair enough. And so coming to the end here, right? Going back to the beginning of this, when we talked about brands, we talked about, you know, Big Beer, for example. As we look to the future, right? And you say you guys are building Cresco for the future, which I 100% agree with. When institutions are able to come into the industry, both investors and other companies, what is it about Cresco Labs that's going to make it jump off the page that they're going to like?
Yeah. How I look at it is, and I don't want to give away too much of our secret sauce here. Mm-hmm. Like I gotta make sure that we are keeping what we think is going to make us the most attractive dance partner. There's an excitement, as we talked about at the beginning of this show, which is the growth prospects of cannabis.
Okay.
The excitement of building these brands and the ability to bring like best in class thinking from CPG combined with like institutional knowledge of cannabis is real, and it's exciting. And I'm pretty sure if you were any brand manager, sales manager over any of traditional CPG companies, you'd be pretty excited about being able to work in cannabis and what you could do in this industry. I think the flip side of that is it's going to be in a different dance with when we are the seller and they're the buyer.
Mm.
And I think, you know, right now I work at Cresco Labs and the others, like we tend to be the buyer, obviously.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff you need to clean up, as you talk about all the time, in the financials of acquisitions and and the realities of the cannabis industry. And there's things that, of course, we deal with because of the upside potential of the license, what the license can do for us and what we can do. And it's a lot, but there's a lot of cleanup that can happen in that. I think CPG companies are not going to have that appetite. Right.
Right.
They are going to want to look and be like, I want to see strong financials. I want to see that you understand the drivers of your financials, what's driving it. I do not want to see one-off spikes. I want to see sustained growth. There are very specific things that I think anyone who's done a diligence at a CPG knows pretty much. And this is not from my time at Molson. This is my time working in management consulting when we were working with big CPGs who were looking to acquire smaller companies. And how did they value them? And what did they look for? Like what excited them and what made them pause and say, not sure. And it's pretty consistent. And so if I look at kind of what we are trying to do without sharing too much of our secret sauce, it is those financials need to be rock solid. There cannot be crazy spikes. There cannot be spikes in the balls. There can't be these like notorious hockey sticks of projected growth. There needs to be sustained results that make sense, that have drivers behind them. There needs to be an ability to talk about your business that is down to what drives it, it's due to. Like we talk about on the wholesale side, how many doors, what's our velocity per door, how many units per door. And I think, you know, you're starting to hear this creep up in cannabis, which I love because I'm a little bit of a data nerd, but it's like distribution. And I think it was Cowan or whatever in the last earnings call was talking a lot about, you know, how are you thinking about TDPs?
Sorry, TDPs?
Total distribution points, right? It is something that if you came from CBG, you're like, oh, of course I can talk about that. That's like IRI, right. Nielsen, like core lingo. Like that is how you build an investment model.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I've never heard of it before. What? 5 years in cannabis, never heard of it.
And it's starting to come in because it makes a lot of sense. Because when you start to dive into how you really should be looking at distribution, it is how many doors, how many brands, how many SKUs do you have there? What's the productivity of your SKU? And that is actually how you start to calculate what's called quality distribution versus you have one brand in one door infrequently. And that's like low quality distribution, which you're like, I don't want to pay for that. I want the brand that's like got that customer relationship. And I think that's the key takeaway we all have to think about is like, okay, someone is going to pay for us. What are they buying? And I don't, what I don't think CPG is going to want that much is they want the growth that they can invest in. They can probably invest in a lower cost of capital. But they want to see a machine that is running well that they can just, you know, gas up. And there's some really, really good, you know, quotes and stuff. If you nerd out on just like when questions like this get posed to CEOs and stuff. And there's one, I can't remember who said it, to look it up, but it was basically, you know, one of the things we had to look for is like the quality of the management team. Are these people you want to work with? Are these people you trust of how they built that business? Because, you know, the last thing you want to do is buy one of these things. And then with the army of folks that work for the Philip Morris's of the world or Imperial Tobacco or ABI, they're going to find every skeleton.
Right.
In the diligence. It's not the diligence like we do, which are these fast, quick, you're pretty bootstrapped with folks and teams. Like they're going to do a cavity search of the entire company.
So what you're saying, just to summarize, is that when the you know big CPG comes, you know, sometimes we might be more, you know, asset focused or value focused, and you know, we don't mind some hair if we're getting value, but that's not how they're gonna play. They're gonna want
fundamentals and an ability. I think they're gonna look at like one, is it a solid core? Like are the fundamentals there, and is it sustained value, like in your brands, in your cultivation, and how you run your business? In the relationships with customers you have, the frequency that you're showing up on shelves is going to be one that's worth buying and paying for. And the other one is, okay, with the capital we have, do you have the rights to be able for us to deploy that capital to continue to get new growth that, at a better rate than you could do because of our size, our industry right now, the cost of capital right now? And that becomes really valuable.
And how important in this conversation is the idea of Cresco being national?
I think it helps. Like, I think it is, again, in the spirit of, you want to invest in something that, has sustainable results and is proven to grow. I think one of the challenges we have, and this is not just for us, this is a challenge of, you know, back to this whole interview is going back to previous conversations. My wife will tell you with like insurgent brands and small brands, regional brands. And one of the challenges, and she does a lot of investing in that space, or advising on how to think about investing in that space, is it proven? Can it scale? Can it go national? Like, you know, in my old world, craft beer, very few, a lot of craft breweries, fairly small percentage of the total market, and very, very few have been able to scale. Right? Like, you know, I think the best, most recent, I'm not going to say best, because I'm not sure it's great, it was like Ballast Point.
Okay.
I forget how much money Constellation paid. It was $1 billion to buy this thing. And it was a leading, you know, West brand. Took it national, huge write down. Because it isn't easy to take a brand in one regional market and take it into international. There's things that are special about brands that can scale. And there's things that are like special about a brand that make it special regionally, but have to stay regional. And so I think national, just if anything, it gives you, it's a proof point. And it also means that it is proven. And so if you put more dollars in it, you're probably going to get better leverage and your dollars are going to work harder for it for you versus if it's a smaller brand, you take the risk of, can I take it nationally? Does it work nationally? You'd think yes, because it's working regionally, but look at how many craft brands from different industries have a hard time scaling outside of their state. So there's inherent risk and it's not totally proven, right? So like, you don't know if it's going to work, if you're going to put money on it. So there's value in national. And then obviously national, like why I think national is so good for companies and particularly ours is that you just get better in return on investment because I can invest in a brand that has a cost to it. There's some cost of taking the brand into different markets, But once I make that investment in the brand, I get to scale that across markets. And I get to scale what we're doing in one market into another market, you know, adhering to the local regulations. But I'm getting scale benefit.
Sorry, go ahead.
And I was going to say, and you know, if you're overly regional, you gotta invest to get that skill.
It strikes me that, just coming to the end here, that the way, you know, maybe we think about being sort of earlier investors in you know, this stage of the cannabis industry, the way we think about risk reward is, this is obvious, almost sounds obvious now that I'm saying it, but we think about risk reward very differently than the next wave of larger investors and operators will. And that, you know, companies like Cresco, for example, will have the things that check the boxes for these companies and make them willing to pay up because they feel the risk quotient is lower.
Yeah. I think, you know, and it goes back to the analogy I have. The future of these companies is that they have the resources to invest in really, really big diligence teams, which we don't have. Like, we only have, you know, we got to do these diligences pretty quickly, and we're looking for things that we're prepared to take an investment stake on because of its future potential. I think as you get ready for the next wave of your suitors, a lot more questions, expect a lot more diligence, and expect a lot more focus on, like, do they have a core that's worth paying for and a pathway to future growth that works for me, because I can take their business model, put my lower cost of capital into it, and grow it. That seems a lot easier to me than if I'm buying a business that has access for growth but hasn't a proven business model, or it's a really good business model, but there's not much more I can do with it with my capital.
Right. That's really interesting. So Greg, listen, you've been really generous with your time. I really appreciate it. As we're at the end here, what would you like to leave listeners with about Cresco Labs?
Yeah, I think, first of all, thank you for having me. Thanks for trying to keep it towards marketing brands and sneaking in a couple of investor questions in here and there.
Only a few.
I think, look, one is thank you for your interest in Cresco Labs. Everyone who's listening, your team. I think, you know, we just have to say thanks for everyone who all of the people who invest in us, who buy our brands, who consume our brands. We're working really, really hard to make this the best company possible. And I think, you know, as we always look at it, it's like, we want to be the partner of choice for our wholesale partners, and we're working really hard to do that. We want to bring consumers the best experiences and brands possible. We're working really hard to do that. And for our investors, like, we are very, very focused on how do we continue to drive really strong, you know, return on your invested capital. And we're working really hard to do that. So thank you for your interest in us. Thank you for your commitment to us. And you know, we're going to keep doing it for you.
Building the perfect partner to be, to drive shareholder returns. That's music to, I think, everybody's ears. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks
for listening.
Having me. And happy to the future when this thing actually goes live.
That's right. CINpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, everybody.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.